D News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which now offers a graduate business track in sports management. With input from senior executives in pro sports, Carthage designed this master's program to comply with employers' needs. More at carthage.edu/graduate. Morning show with Greg Berg is up shortly.
Best-selling author J. Randy Tarabarelli. I have spoken with him on several previous occasions. I believe the first time was to talk about his outstanding biography of Elizabeth Taylor, and our subsequent interviews have included conversations about a couple of different books related to the Kennedy family. In fact, three of them in all. We talked about Jackie Ethel Kennedy, Joan, Women of Camelot, Jackie, Janet, and Lee, and then the Kennedy heirs. Today we are talking about a book which is every bit as fascinating as those books. In fact, maybe even more so. Maybe more so in the sense that I feel like I learned a tremendous amount from the book Grace and Steel, Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the Women of the Bush Dynasty. These are familiar names to just about all Americans, and yet not necessarily people that we know as well as we might think. And that beneath the surface, they have complicated personalities, have lived complicated lives, and lives that have been amazingly rich and interesting. And they have made a tremendous difference in the lives of the Bush men with whom they have lived and loved, including, of course, two U.S. presidents. And I'm grateful to J. Randy Tarabarelli for joining me today on the morning show to talk about this endlessly fascinating book published by St. Martin's Press, again titled Grace and Steel. J. Randy Tarabarelli, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me again. I really appreciate it. Every time I do a book, I look forward to talking to you about it. So thank you so much.
So this particular book was no small feat to put together. It was, in fact, as you tell us in the acknowledgments, a book 20 years in the making. Explain to our listeners what happened back in 2000, which caused you to, in a sense, first launch this idea.
Well, as I wrote in the book, in the year 2000, I had the opportunity to interview Barbara Bush for a women's magazine. And in talking to her, I just found her to be so fascinating. And I wanted to write her autobiography with her. I just thought that would be such a great opportunity for me to tell her story in that way. But she was working on her own book at that time. And so I wasn't able to do it. And I remember President Bush, H.W. Bush, told me, you know, let her get that out of her system and then, you know, we'll see what we see, you know. And coming from the president, I thought, wow, that, I don't know if that's a promise or what, but I hope he's right. But then I went on with my career and I wrote, as you mentioned, Elizabeth Taylor, and I wrote, you know, Grace Kelly, and I just went on with my career. But after writing Jackie, Janet, and Lee a couple of years ago about Jackie Kennedy, her mother, and her sister, I thought, how interesting might it be to do the Bush dynasty in that same way? And I went back and I listened to my interviews with Barbara Bush, and And I realized that in the course of those conversations, she talked a lot about her mother-in-law, Dorothy. And I did a lot more research into the life of Dorothy Walker Bush, and I realized that she really is sort of the linchpin to the Bush dynasty, and that's what really inspired me to want to write this book. You know, the life and times of a woman that is not well known to the public, who has sort of a hidden history, Dorothy Walker Bush, but who was so important to the Bush family and so important to our culture that I just thought that this would be an opportunity to shed some light on her story.
By the way, I just can't resist mentioning something that you yourself talk about in this little section called The Story Behind Grace and Steel. And that is that as you are kind of taking this up and then putting it aside, this idea of writing a book about Barbara Bush, you end up at that point in time, I think in 2014, putting it aside in order to write a biography of Beyonce. And it's just kind of so intriguing to me. And of course, you acknowledge too, I mean, talk about two women poles apart. And of course, that's one hallmark of your prolific and successful career, is that you're writing about people like Beyonce and Diana Ross and Madonna and Cher, and you're writing about people like Barbara Bush and Laura Bush and so on. How different do those pursuits feel, or are they all just biographies, and are they all essentially the same kind of project, the same kind of work, albeit about very, very different women?
Well, you know, the one thing that I think is true of all of my subjects, whether they're, you know, pop music stars, you know, like Beyonce or Michael Jackson, or whether they're political figures, you know, like the Kennedys or the Bushes, is the humanity of their lives. And what I look for in a subject is a story that my readers can relate to. Because the goal for me is to tell a story that a reader can sort of become absorbed in and see him or herself in that story. You know, I mean, I think that what I like to do is strip away the celebrity, the money, you know, the fame, and all of that from my subjects and see what's left. And if what's left is a really true human story, then it's a good story for me. And in the case of Beyonce, you know, she has such a great story of survival and struggle. It really worked for me. But it was such a different experience than writing about a political family. And it's just a different language, you know, to a pop star's life. And so, yeah, that was a bit of a stretch at that time. But I'm really glad I did it, because it turned out to be such a fun book, and she's such a great person. Mm-hmm. And I had a great time with that.
Well, you certainly have done something terrific with this newest book, which is again titled Grace and Steel: Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the Women of the Bush Dynasty. And as you've already touched on, it's really when you came to realize that your book needed to include extensive exploration of Dorothy Bush, the mother of President H.W. Bush. You needed to include Dorothy Bush in the mix for this story to be truly complete. And what a fascinating woman she was, and so important to this family. One of the things that you say about her is that, and I believe you might be quoting someone close to the family and saying, perhaps the most misunderstood of all the Bush women was Dorothy Bush. In what way has she been misunderstood?
Well, you know, if you read anything about her prior to my book, what you read is, you know, that she was just a gentle soul who was full of love and warmth for her family members. And that's pretty much it. And that's true, as I wrote in the book. Of course, that was true. But there's so much more to Dorothy Bush than that. And that's what I wanted to explore in this book. Because she was a feminist long before the idea of feminism had even been conceived. Back in the 1940s and 1950s, she insisted on a marriage of equality with her husband, Senator Prescott Bush. And I found it so interesting that she often coached her daughter-in-law, Barbara Bush, that she would say to Barbara, you don't have to do everything that my son tells you to do. Because Barbara was very unhappy in the 1950s in her marriage, in the respect that George Bush had the family move from city to city because of his business concerns, and she would just have to pack up all these kids, five of them, and move them from one place to the other, and then she was responsible for, you know, raising the children, and George didn't really ask for her opinion about anything. Not that Barbara demanded that he do so, because Barbara was a very traditional 1950s housewife who just pretty much listened to whatever it is her husband told her to do. And Dorothy was so far ahead of her time that she would tell her daughter-in-law, you don't have to do that. You should have more agency in your marriage. Hmm. And don't forget, H.W. was her son. So for Dorothy to be telling her daughter-in-law, you don't have to listen to everything my son tells you to do, I just thought that was so interesting, you know. And Dorothy was such a fascinating person who wrote a political column for 10 years, the 10 years that her husband was a senator. She wrote a column called My Life as a Senator's Wife. And she wrote this column 3 days a week for 10 years. That's more than 1,000 columns. And I had access to all of these columns from researching of my book, which gave me such a roadmap to not only Dorothy's life, but to her influence on Barbara. Mm. And it was almost as if she was, you know, sort of coaching me from the great beyond as to how to tell her story, because it was all there for me, right in front of me.
Wonderful.
It was just an amazing experience.
And I'm so glad you talk about this particular exchange you were referencing with Barbara Bush, because as you point out, it was such a reversal of what one might expect. In terms of what the older generation would be telling the younger generation. And here it is, Dorothy Bush, who is at that moment in time, in a sense, being more of the feminist. And you tell us she was really a feminist long before that term was ever even coined. And she was this kind of strong woman while being married to a very strong-willed husband, Prescott Sheldon Bush. Tell our listeners about the interesting moment involving a certain desk and the placement of that desk, because it tells us a whole lot about their marriage and about Dorothy Bush's strength of purpose.
Thank you for allowing me to tell that story, because I haven't told it yet to anybody, and I love it. You know, when the Bushes first moved into their home in Connecticut, Prescott, you know, found the room that he decided was going to be his den. And he moved his enormous desk into this room. And Dorothy's, you know, sort of little desk, her little sort of Victorian desk, was in another room. And when Prescott went to work that day, Dorothy and her secretary moved her desk downstairs, and Dorothy was pregnant at this time. They managed to get her desk downstairs and into this room that Prescott thought was his den. And when he came home from work, he realized that Dorothy's desk was in there as well as his own, and that they would be sharing that space. In other words, she would not allow him to have sort of his man cave, which would be called today. She wanted there to be equality. You know, we both get to use this room. And I love the fact that they then use that room as their sort of personal inner sanctum. You know, that when they as a couple wanted to discuss the family, or they wanted to discuss Prescott's, you know, senatorial obligations or whatever was going on politically, they would go into this room that Prescott had once cordoned off as his room, that Dorothy turned into their room, and they would close the door and they would sit on the couch together and they would, you know, talk over everything that needed to be discussed. That's the kind of equality that she sought for in her marriage to Prescott. And, you know, he went sort of kicking and screaming along with the program, but he did go along with the program, because, you know, she was insistent upon it, and they had a very, very good marriage for a very long time.
You call her at one point a woman of substance. Actually, I think it might be Barbara who called Dorothy Bush a woman of substance, and your book really helps us understand just how true those words were. Barbara Bush is an equally fascinating figure, and one of the things that you help us understand about her is the difficult relationship she had with her own mother, Pauline, which really seemed to have lasting ramifications for who Barbara Bush was and how she saw herself and others. Just say a quick word about what made their relationship so difficult.
Well, when I interviewed Barbara, I remember asking her about her mother, and she said to me, you know, my mother had many interests, and unfortunately, I was not one of them. And I thought that was such a sad commentary about her mom. But when I researched my book, I found that Pauline was a very critical person, and she felt that it was her responsibility to make sure other people had what she saw as better lives. And so she was very critical of Barbara and Barbara's weight and Barbara's appearance, and had a very contentious and difficult relationship with her. But what I also found about Pauline was that, you know, she suffered for years from depression. And Barbara then later also suffered from depression. And this is during a period of time when depression wasn't really even understood, let alone talked about. And people just thought that back in the 1950s, when if a person suffered from depression, people just thought that was a person who was in a bad mood. You know, there was like no understanding of the idea of you know, chronic depression in a person. And Pauline suffered from it greatly, as did Barbara later. And I think that was largely responsible for sort of her prickly nature, where not only Barbara was concerned, but the rest of her family as well.
One of the things you tell us about Barbara Bush's personality and kind of attitude is that she was rock solid and unapologetic. And for whatever warmth and sort of lightness of spirit that she publicly projected, and to some extent, of course, shared with family and close friends, there was this other side of her, and it could sometimes be a source of difficulty. Tell us more about that.
Well, you know, I'm trying to just sort of summarize it for you, but I think that a crucible moment in Barbara's life was the death of her 3-year-old daughter, Robin, of leukemia. And in my book, Jenna Welch, who is Laura Bush's mother, is trying to explain to Laura why she's not able to connect with Barbara, because Laura felt that she wanted more of a relationship with her mother-in-law, and Barbara was just sort of not accessible emotionally. You know, there always seemed to be a wall up between Laura and Barbara. And Jenna told Laura, you know, when a mother loses a child, you never get over that. And it changes who you are. And you have to give latitude to Barbara Bush and let her come to you in her own time and in her own way. And I think a lot of Barbara's prickly nature, you know, which she inherited from her mom, a lot of it had to do with, you know, just the deep sadness that she felt over the loss of her child at such an early age. And I think it also had to do with, you know, the fact that she suffered from depression as well. Even her own family members didn't know that Barbara suffered from depression until she wrote about it in her book, the book that I earlier mentioned that I wanted to work with her on. When that book came out, maybe 15 or 18 years ago, and Barbara wrote about her bouts with depression, that was news to her family, to her children. Her children didn't even know that she suffered from depression.
Wow.
You know, it's just amazing, you know, to me that they didn't know this, that George W. Bush was astounded to read this in his mom's book.
Right.
That's how much these things were not talked about, you know? So I think that, you know, you have to understand the total full person and have context for their lives, and that's what I tried to do with this book.
Right. And I think you do a marvelous job. And it also helps us remind us, although I think we're coming to a better understanding, that the public face of depression can sometimes be misunderstood. And even someone who projected positivity and vigor the way Barbara Bush did can be actually on the inside deeply depressed. And indeed, this is something she contended with for many, many years. Your portrait of Laura Bush, I think, is equally fascinating. And one of the things that we learn about in your book in much greater detail than has ever really been shared before is an enormous tragedy that was part of her life when she was just a teenager. Tell our listeners, some of whom may have never even heard anything at all about this, about the tragic car accident in which she was a part and the shadow that this lay over her life for many, many years.
Well, you know, you're right. Many people don't know about this, and I I'm always surprised at how little people realize that, you know, Laura had this crucible when she was young. When she was 17 years old, she was behind the wheel of a car, and she was driving with a friend when she ran through a stop sign, and she hit another car. And the driver of that car, 17-year-old boy named Michael Douglas, was killed. And Mike Douglas was a friend of Laura's from high school. She was responsible for his death. And this happened when she was 17 years old. Well, you know, obviously the trauma of this, the emotional devastation of this, and the guilt that Laura carried with her for, you know, many, many years after that tragedy, changed who she was as a person. And she spent a number of years after that tragedy just sort of living in a black and white world, you know, where she became a librarian, and she had little contact with people, and she was very sort of a very internal kind of person who was just suffering until she met George W. Bush. And I like to think that he added a sort of technicolor to her black and white world when they met, because he saw in her this sort of damaged person, and he wanted to help her come out of it, and he did help her, and she helped him. I mean, he had his own demons. You know, he was a heavy drinker, and, you know, he was a womanizer. I mean, he was a good old boy from Texas, you know, who his family didn't really believe in him. I mean, his family thought that W was not going to be the president. They thought that Jeb was going to be president one day. But Laura saw so much in George, and she saw so much potential in him. So he was able to bring her out of her sadness, and she was able to bring him out of sort of his bad boy years. And they've been married for more than 40 years. But to get back to the original question, you know, this crucible that Laura went through when she was a teenager, I think gave her such empathy as a first lady. And during the time of 9/11, when Laura was first lady during the tragedy of 9/11, and when she went and visited hospitals and talked to children and tried to calm America after this horrible thing that happened, it was a moment that she was able to rise to the occasion because of what she'd been through in her life, you know, because she understood pain and suffering, and she understood PTSD. And she understood how hard it is to get on with your life after a tragedy. Hmm. She was the perfect first lady for the times, in other words.
Yeah, she really was. Served our nation faithfully. And one of the things that you also explore in your book is the fact that Laura Bush is a Democrat. And, of course, George W. Bush, her husband, is a Republican. And so there has always been, between the two of them, something of a political divide, but no divide at all when it comes to their devotion to one another. I think we need to spend a moment talking about Laura Bush's mother, Jenna. She ends up being, in a sense, one of the most impressive women that you explore in your book. And she contends with some of her own difficulty, including the excessive drinking of her own husband. And the thing that intrigues me so much about her story is that you tell us that because of her difficult marriage, Jenna decided to expand her horizons, to expand her life. And we so often hear of people in such difficult situations doing just the opposite, retreating from the world, shrinking their life. And she did the opposite. And what a great example she was for all kinds of other people, including her own daughter.
Yeah, she's an incredible woman. Thank you for allowing me to talk about her as well, because I haven't had a chance to talk about her much during my interviews for this book. And you're right. You know, she built a life for herself that in some ways didn't really include her husband, who was so emotionally distant. And she became interested in astronomy, for instance, and she took classes in astronomy. She took classes in bird watching, you know. I mean, she was just so invested in books. But what I love most about Jenna is that she and Laura used to sit on a blanket in their backyard and look at the stars. And Jenna, who was sort of a small town West Texas kind of girl, you know, Jenna was raised in West Texas. And you would think that that would be a mother who would tell her daughter, you know, you need to stay here and raise a family, and West Texas is a wonderful place for you to live the rest of your life. And that was not Jenna's message to Laura. Jenna's message to Laura is that as they're looking at the stars, she would tell her, this is a big, big world, and you should get out there and explore it, you know? And if you find that West Texas is where you want to be, then you should come back here and live in West Texas. But have the opportunity to live your life. And Laura, at that time when she was young, her whole thing was, I don't want to leave here. Like, I love this life, you know? But Jenna kept telling her that there's more to it. And, of course, as we see in Laura's trajectory, she lived a life so much bigger than the small town of you know, Midland, Texas. You know, she lived a big, big life, and she was not afraid to take on being the first lady of Texas when W became governor. And she was not afraid to take on being the first lady of our country when W became president. And a lot of that is because her mom always told her that she could achieve anything she wanted to achieve, and she could live any life that she wanted to live, and that there was much more for her than what might have been restricted if she had just stayed in a small town in West Texas. I just think that that's an incredible mom, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. A last quick question. One of the things I so appreciate about your book is that when you explore these various women and some of their troubles and trials, one of the things you, in a sense, chronicle for us is the different ways in which they themselves would talk about these things. For instance, Barbara Bush and how she and her husband grappled with the tragedy of their young daughter's bout with leukemia, which ultimately claimed her life when she was just 4 years old. And the way Barbara Bush would talk about that, or talk about the final surgery they approved for little Robin, that sometimes she would talk about that, sometimes she wouldn't, sometimes she would kind of change that. And that's one of many examples in your book. You clearly not only talk to people, but also spend a lot of time with what these women themselves said about themselves and their own lives, and found all kinds of fascinating comparisons between the different ways or the different accounts they would have of what had befallen them. Can you just say a word about just how interesting that in and of itself is for someone like you crafting a book like this?
Thank you for asking that question, because it is interesting to me, you know, that, you know, this is what we do. You know, this isn't just reserved for public figures. You know, we go through our lives sort of reimagining our past, you know, and we either forget what really happened, or we just as soon try to forget what really happened. And this is how we cope. And, you know, Barbara coped with the death of Robin, you know, by by many ways, I won't get into it now specifically, but you'll read in the book, you know, that she told herself some things that weren't necessarily true, but it's how she coped with her daughter's death. And I just think that that's what we do, you know. And what I try to do with the book is not be judgmental about that. I mean, if any reader of my books is ever, you know, critical or judgmental of my subjects, then I have not done my job, because that's not my intention ever. My intention is just to shed light on the human condition. And I want my readers to understand that if this is what you have done to cope with tragedy, you're not the only one. You know, that this is sometimes how we cope. You know, we tell ourselves the stories that we need to hear to get through the day. And that is something that I think that Barbara Bush did in order to cope with the tragedy of her daughter.
Mm. Yes, and it's just one more way in which these famous women become still more human to us. The book again is Grace and Steel, Dorothy, Barbara, Laura, and the Women of the Bush Dynasty, published by St. Martin's Press, the author J. Randy Tarabarelli. Thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book, and thank you for being my guest today on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. A wonderful, colorful, intriguing, creatively crafted children's book has just crossed my desk, and this book is called Beautiful Oops. It is a book which celebrates mistakes, and the way in which what would seem like an irreparable and entirely regrettable mistake can in fact be a blessing in disguise. And I am so excited to talk with the man responsible for this wonderful book. His name is Barney Salzberg. And if you have children's books on your shelf at home, maybe you know his best-selling book, Peekaboo Kisses, as well as last year's book called Good Egg, which is an interactive book. And Beautiful Oops is a book which is also something you have to sort of experience in person. It's a book you hold in your hands and in some respects manipulate to experience some of these mistakes and to see them before your eyes transformed into something wonderful and creative. And Barney Salzberg joins us for the next few minutes to talk about his wonderful book and his career in children's literature. This book, by the way, is published by Workman Publishing. Barney Salzberg, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Nice to be here. Good morning.
I'm especially excited about this because right down the road from our radio station at Carthage College is the Center for Children's Literature. And over the last several years, I've had the great pleasure of interviewing an array of people involved in the children's book industry. And I have come to, as someone who doesn't have kids himself, I've come to a much deeper understanding of the special challenges that are involved in this field. And so every time I have the chance to talk to someone who creates books for children, I do it with a kind of a new sense of appreciation for what you do. Has this always been what you wanted to do professionally?
For a really long time. My first children's book was published in 1981. So this has been a lifelong project for me, process for me, and something I've always loved. I actually found a children's book before I had kids, before I was married. And I was so intrigued with the artwork in it and realized after I bought it, just because I liked looking at it, that it had a great story. And that sort of sparked the idea that maybe I could do this. I had been a songwriter before that and always loved playing with words, but writing a story was a daunting task. This book is a departure in that it really isn't a story per se, but it is an interactive experience in playing with what we think are mistakes. It's a little different.
It's a wonderful book. I loved every page. Just talking for a moment again in more overarching way about your whole career. As you began doing this, I think some people enter this with not a full understanding of actually how tricky it is to craft good books for children. I mean, I think some people at least assume it to be a lot easier than in fact it is. I mean, I think they assume it would be a lot easier than writing a book for their own peers.
Right.
What were your expectations or fears and or confidences about what this would be like?
I think I was fairly clueless. I live in Los Angeles, and I teach a class once a year in writing and illustrating picture books at UCLA. And I'm in the middle of a class now, and it's fascinating because I've seen it over the years. People do come in and expect this to be easy. And I have in the description of my course that it is like writing a haiku. It's actually very difficult because every single word has to count. And if you start speaking down to a child, you've lost the game and your book falls apart. Your story doesn't become a book. It's very tricky. It really is. And how to captivate someone's attention. These are books that are read over and over and over again. And they really have to work, and there's a lot more involved. My wife is an attorney, and she watches me in this process and cannot figure out how I can possibly do this. It's a lot of work. A story that might take 3 minutes to read could take me anywhere up to 5 to 10 years to write. That's, you know, don't translate that into dollars.
We're speaking with Barney Salzburg, and we are talking about the most recent of his many children's books, and this one is called Beautiful Oops. You know, it occurs to me, by the way, for those of us that kind of wonder about the future of books, that is physical books versus e-books, that probably one realm in which we're going to see real books maintain their foothold for a long time is in the realm of children's books, exactly because of books like this that you just have to hold in your hands.
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah, I do. I'm very well aware of it at this point in time. I think publishers are all looking around to see how this is going to impact our books. It's much different than translating a novel into a digital book, because every picture book is different. And is it going to talk to you? Is it going to move? Is it going to sing? Is it going to just be a flat book that you turn the pages? This is clearly something that needs more involvement because it is interactive.
Right. And reading it and experiencing it is a very tactile experience. Tell us where the initial idea came from.
Well, I travel around the country speaking to educators and to students, and two of the slides in my PowerPoint show how I fixed mistakes. I spilled coffee on a sketchbook. I always ask the kids how many of you would want a new sketchbook if you had a stain like this, and they all raise their hand. And I show them that in the next picture how I took that stain and drew a monster in it. Teachers have been saying, can't you get that across in a story? And I really didn't know if I could. And I kept trying it out in stories, and they felt too preachy to me. And one day I tore a piece of paper partway in half in my studio, realized that it looked like the mouth of an alligator. And I could, in fact, now start exploring what other mistakes, spilling things, tearing things, stains, smears, smudges, bending paper in a way that I wouldn't necessarily want, how could I then turn those around? And they all were unexpected challenges for me with really lovely results.
Wow. So that's literally what you did. I mean, this was a case of sort of trial and error and experimentation to come up with some of these other transformed mistakes.
Completely. I mean, even to the point that I crumbled up a piece of paper, as we've all done, in frustration of not making something the way we want, whether we're drawing a picture or writing a story. I guess that was more common when we had typewriters, but still the idea that you wad something up to throw it out. And I thought, to be true to the spirit of this book, there must be a way to integrate that rumpled up piece of paper into the book. And I made it into a sheep, and it worked.
It's great. It's towards the very end of the book, and it's a great little aha moment. There are a lot of them in this book. Once you had sort of assembled the basic kind of mistakes that you wanted to see in the pages of the book, then what was the process like to go from initial ideas sketched on notebook paper or whatever to the finished reality of the book itself?
Well, I actually never made, I mean, when I do a picture book, I will write it and then make what's known as a storyboard, where I map out on one piece of paper and little thumbnail sketches a book. This one, it was a much more hands-on process, and I didn't even know the order of it, other than the first one I ever did was the torn piece of paper, and that ended up being in the beginning of the book as well. But it was really a process of what could I do as far as activities that would lend themselves to the printed page. And once it was together, and I wrote something on each page, a torn piece of paper, it became as just the beginning. You know, every spill has lots and lots of possibilities. Those could really have been in any particular order. It summarized the end with the philosophy of the book, and it needed to wrap up and sort of be a culmination of all of the different things that had happened leading up to the end. I wanted to show how they would all look, creating one, actually what it becomes a three-page spread to end the book. And the line there is, when you think you've made a mistake, look at it as an opportunity to make something beautiful. And it sort of was a perfect way to end it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about the nuts and bolts of this book being constructed, in terms of how one sort of creates these sort of pop-up effects of one kind or another. I mean, and are we talking about a whole team of people that make such a thing possible? I mean, how much were you specifically involved?
Well, what you're seeing in the book is what I turned in. That's what I gave them. I built that book.
Really?
Yeah. They were able to reproduce it, but I built it. I'm not a paper engineer. I mean, lift the flap is a fairly basic concept to do. The biggest challenge was there's an accordion piece that pulls way out, and I had seen that same technique in another book, and I studied it and adapted it for my book, but I actually built one.
Hmm.
Theirs looks a little better than mine now that my publishers made it, but they knew what I was going for. It was a crude version of this, but there are very few publishers that could pull off a book like this, and Workman was my first choice, and my editor there, Raquel, just totally got this concept and ran with it. And not only does this look like my book dummy, which is what you call a book that you send in, but it was stunning. I mean, they pushed it and used wonderful paper and great ink process so that there's pieces that are shiny, there's pieces that are flat. I was knocked out when I saw it, and that doesn't happen a lot.
Right.
They really knew how to do it.
Yeah. So let's give our listeners just a little clearer idea of some of what they find in this book. So we open up the book. The title page, again, is Beautiful Oops. We flip to the first full spread, and there in big letters and sort of splattery letters is the word oops with a big exclamation point, and the opposite side is a tear in the sheet. It's a very thick page, but there's a big tear at the bottom, a torn piece of paper, and we turn the page, and what do we find?
It says it's just the beginning, and that tear on the reverse side has now become the mouth of a giant green alligator.
And it fits exactly perfectly to form that mouth. And with very few words and just this single image, you are inviting us to explore the rest of the book. There is one spread where we see bent paper, just those two big words, and sure enough, the top right-hand corner of the right page is folded down, and from that vantage point, it looks like a mistake. And we flip to the next spread, and what do we see?
Well, that page was flipped so the other way, so that when you're looking at the book, it's sort of just missing, that corner is missing. When you turn it, that little dog-eared piece has became the head of a penguin. We have three penguins holding hands, and it says, bent paper is something to celebrate, and it felt like a happy picture, so that seemed like a perfect thing to call it.
Absolutely, with that little dog-eared page corner that helps to form the beak of the penguin, and of course that penguin is the than by far the most vivid of the three that we see. We should mention to our listeners this moment in the book that involved that sort of accordion piece, which is especially beautiful and wonderful. And in the spread before, we read, "Holes in your paper." And again, we see on the right-hand side a round hole right in the middle of the page. And then we flip, and you have the words, "are worth exploring." And then what do we see? Try to describe this wonderful accordion piece to our listeners.
Well, it's a sort of a rectangle sandwiched piece of paper that's connected to other pieces when you pull it out, but there's a hole. And I had initially written, pull out and look inside. My editor felt people would figure it out. I have to sit on my hands when I watch adults read it because most of them just pull it out and look at it from the side and go, that's nice. But when you do look through it, it's almost like looking through a telescope, and you're seeing different sheets as you look through it with different images on them, and you're looking all the way down to the bottom where there's a little character with a message, which is C-S-E-E, which is what I'm hoping you're doing and you see when you look at this book.
Absolutely. And again, from start to finish, it just has this wonderful sense of surprise about it. And sometimes we read such books, and the surprise is very, very evident. And these surprises are very well hidden, in a sense. And the product, obviously, a very fertile imagination. Before you turned this in, did you try it out on young listeners, young readers, or were you pretty certain that this was something that they were going to really enjoy?
This one I kind of got. I mean, I'm always forcing people who come over to look at what I'm working on. And it's funny, Jamie Lee Curtis is a friend of mine. Not close, but we've bumped into each other over the years in Los Angeles. And she had just said, I'd love to get together. And when someone like that says, I want to get together, I followed through with that. And she was in my studio looking at my books that I was working on. And this book she found before I had sent it out. And she said, what is that? And we sat down, and luckily for me, she held onto my leg the entire time she read it and was squeezing it going, this book is going to change your life. She goes, I have goosebumps, and that's always a sign. And I knew I had something special with that response. It was just truly inspiring to see how she got this book and then offered this beautiful quote, which my publisher put on the cover. I was a little embarrassed. I thought they'd stick it on the back, but it was so taken with what she said that they put it on the front. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get sued here. But Jamie actually gave me her seal of approval and even came to the book signing when we launched the book in L.A.
Wow. Yeah, this is someone who knows something about creating fine children's books. She says everyone who has ever said the word oops will be smiling when they see the masterpiece that Barney Salzberg has created. Funny and fun, beautiful oops is the best gift to give anyone, any age, anywhere, anytime. Yeah, endorsements don't come much more ringing than that one.
Well, yeah, and I've talked to people who have met her and asked her for endorsements, and she's passed. So I felt really honored. And to say what she said, I still get tingles hearing that. It was pretty much an honor, because I think she really, out of all the movie stars who are doing books, she knows what she's doing.
Absolutely.
She really does.
The book, again, is Beautiful Oops. It is published by Workman, and the man responsible for it, I was going to say, who wrote it. I mean, the words here don't matter. I mean, the words matter, of course, some, but what really matters is this as a whole, the words and the image and the idea, all of that from the fertile imagination of Barney Salzberg. Barney Salzberg, I so enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about this wonderful book. Best wishes with all the books which you are yet to create.
Thank you for taking the time. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. Get more information online at carthage.edu.